Welcome to the 29th Annual Executive War College brought to you by The Dark Report. This year's conference was in beautiful New Orleans, April 30th through May 1st. The title of this presentation is New Developments at the FDA, Draft LDT Rule, Harmonization of ISO 13485, Memo on Reclassification of Certain Assays, and more. The presenter is Tim Stenzel, MD, CEO, Gray Haven LLC, Crystal, Minnesota.
So next I'd like to introduce someone well known to me, a colleague, Dr. Tim Stenzel. We've worked extensively over our careers in different ways, and he's here to talk about a topic which is very timely in terms of the proposed and now finalized rule for FDA oversight of laboratory developed tests. Dr. Stenzel.
Thank you, Bill. And thank you, Robert, for the invite. Pleasure to be here, and hopefully my remarks will be helpful to you. So first thing to say, you can see the title has been updated because now the final rule dropped yesterday. I'll do some disclaimers in the next slide. But I also wanted to say that I formed an LLC primarily for public speaking. Little did I know when I left the agency and have no affiliations that I would potentially putting myself and my family at risk, so I was advised to form an LLC, and that's why I have. All right, let's see if I know how to do this. Yes, so disclaimers. So I'm speaking for myself. I'm not speaking for the FDA. I am not going to disclose any either FDA confidential information, nor will I disclose any company confidential information. I do want to go back to the fact that the final rule dropped or was made public yesterday. I started reviewing it on the plane ride here. I radically updated my talk because it is substantially different from the proposed rule that was announced last October. All right. So this is the agenda. I'm going to hop through a number of topics here and then end on what probably is the most interesting topic for you all. So first of all, almost a year ago, we started a pilot at the FDA, certain oncology drugs used with certain IVD tests. There's multiple different shorthand names for this. CDX pilot was one. It was an effort to provide greater transparency when LDTs that had not been reviewed by the agency were used in clinical studies for drug approval. And so this was a growing problem for the agency, especially given that there are so many targeted drugs targeting rare genetic findings. And so in order for drug sponsors to capture those rare patients, they have to do clinical studies in a way that casts a very wide net. And doing that required them to work with labs that weren't using FDA-cleared or approved tests. And so how does the agency get their hands around that and ensure that there at least is a floor of quality? And so that's what this program was for. Drug sponsors could apply. Data would be collected on every test that was used to select patients. There would be no requirement for the LDTs to come in for authorization. This process wouldn't authorize any specific LDTs. They could still come in, kits or LDTs, come in for FDA approval as a separate process. But this is aimed at trying to understand what were the performance characteristics of the tests in the clinical trial that could then be used to put in the drug label and applied to any, informally really, to any lab that wants to do this kind of testing after the drug is approved. Next topic is a hot topic as well, multi-cancer detection assays. There's dozens of assays, more than 30 that I know of in development. Some have launched clinically as an LDT. None are FDA approved. The FDA is highly likely, however, in my opinion, to approve these assays if they're accurate, especially for cancers that are without a formal screening program. So I think there is a very clear pathway to get an FDA approval. Now, with the current final rule, We'll see what happens with that, whether there's a need to do that. I do believe that these tests will face certain regulatory reimbursement hurdles. Not my core area of expertise, but worthy of some discussion. Recently, earlier this year, the FDA had a memo on its decision to initiate a process of reclassification of Class 3 IVDs. This actually publicly began long ago, prior to my arrival in 2018 at the FDA. More than 1,000 IVDs were declared exempt from FDA review. They would still be regulated by the FDA, but they didn't need to come in for authorization prior to being launched. Then those efforts continued with other reclassification efforts. For example, FDA on November 19th, 2021, downclassified HCV, certain of them, essentially all of them, to that weren't involved in donor screening, that, for marketing clearance rather than PMA. And then last September, the FDA held a panel on essentially all of the remaining IVDs in the infectious disease space that were still Class 3 and hadn't been prior reviewed and discussed. And that meeting was, I believe, successful, and all of the panel were unanimous in their opinion that these Class 3 devices or tests could be downclassified, in particular HBV. Of course, HBV is very important with the administration's desire to eliminate HCV because treatments for HCV are sometimes counterindicated in HBV actively infected patients. So even though HCV is downclassified and more testing should be able to be developed and gotten through the FDA more easily with HBV still being a Class 3 product, then that does present a regulatory hurdle that, you know, at least based on the meeting, seems like can be reclassified. And so this new effort is really to continue all of that. It's taking it to companion diagnostics. The important element for the FDA and their rules is that in order to downclassify something from Class 3 to Class 2, special controls have to be written. This is a document that lays out how the testing and validation of that testing should be done in order to be classified as Class 2 and allowed to follow the 510K pathway. So if you come through the de novo pathway, that's really the FDA's signal. We're willing to go to Class 2, but in the process, the FDA writes these special controls for that specific reg. So this process is likely to take several years, unfortunately. It's not all in the control of the FDA. But I love the goal. I think it's going to be helpful to the entire community. Recently announced as final guidance is the harmonization of ISO 13485 and FDA QSRs. This will be a multi-year process to institute this. This is a long-standing goal of the agency, largely expressed through their participation in the International Medical Device Regulators Forum, or IMDRF for short. And this follows on the heels of a very successful medical device single audit program, the MDSAP program, where manufacturers sign up to, you know, for relevant countries who buy into this, they sign up for just one audit rather than potentially being audited by multiple countries. And then that simplifies their lives. This has been a tremendous hit. There is ultimately the goal of having a medical device single review program where you could submit to any signatory country the application is reviewed by that country's regulators, and then all of the other regulators who have signed on would abide by that decision, you know, presumably a positive decision, and then you don't have to go. And I know that from my prior FDA days, that can be really challenging, where I was in charge of regulating, of making sure that we were properly regulating tests all across the world. And in each region of the world, there's different rules. Sometimes you've got to do clinical studies in multiple countries, so that is, can be very challenging. So this will ease the work of test developers who operate both in the U.S. and internationally. And most of those companies already are ISO 1348 compliant, 485 compliant, or they're actually audited. Every company I work for prior to join the FDA was audited by ISO and compliant and deemed accredited. An even more recent development for those in the know is the FDA's apparent relook at RUO kit manufacturers. So there was a recent warning letter, I think, became pretty well known within our community. And, you know, the use of RUO reagents and kits in test development is commonplace. Every developer does this. Even traditional kit manufacturers do this. I certainly did this because you can't always buy every component that is, you know, FDA regulated. But you bring it under your quality system, you validate it, you design, you know, your incoming QC, all that, so that you can, that you take responsibility for that RUO product, that you know that when it goes in your test that it's going to work and your test is going to work. So that's longstanding. The FDA realizes that. However, you know, what happened recently really, you know, caught a lot of people's attention, and, you know, really laid down some elements that the FDA hasn't forgotten about. There's a 2013 guidance on the use of RUO reagents and kits, particularly those that might be designed for clinical use but have not been come through the FDA. So I do encourage all developers to refamiliarize yourself with that guidance. Look at this warning letter. It's almost a textbook legal case, looking at the guidance and the warning letter elements. I mean, they just line up so beautifully. It just emphasizes that the FDA does not want RUO manufacturers making kits and selling them solely or essentially to clinical labs for clinical use. That's a loophole that exists right now. All right, on to the, you know, most interesting topic. So I said I think it's quite different from the proposed rule. So the final rule was announced yesterday. You know, there's, you gotta read the details about when it really comes into force and when certain, you know, dates pass and, you know, and then that starts the clock for this phased in or phase out approach. You know, the core of it is it changes materially the definition of an IVD product, you know, quote, including when the manufacturer of these products is a laboratory. So that's the clarification that the FDA sought. It was the key that was the clear goal of this. I think the FDA really wished that VALID had passed back at the end of 2022. I think they've publicly said that, and I think they were left with no choice but to go forward with rulemaking, which they had been told over years that they would have to do if they didn't go the legislative route. So let's just kind of hop through some of the things here. So there is a change in some of the phase-out period deliverables, and these are these need to be accomplished at least by the end of each time period. So year one, it's the end of year one to comply with medical device adverse event reporting. So if you have a problem with your test, or you notice a problem with your test, and you confirm that problem, then that does require the lab at that point to report it to the FDA as an MDR. Also, once you confirm that you might have a problem with a test, you might need to, you know, tell your customers, your clients, your clinicians, your patients that there's a problem. you know, and this has been done in the lab industry for a long time, but this is formalized. This would involve notifying the FDA that you're doing a correction or removal or a recall. At the end of year two, comply with labeling, registration, and listing, and investigational use requirements. So labeling is, if you've ever read a kit label, really all that information, they'd like that to be made available to not just the FDA, but to your clients, you know, so they know, just like it was an FDA cleared or approved test, what the performance is, how the studies were done, et cetera, what the claims are. Registration listing is simply, you know, putting yourself on the list of the FDA so that they know you are a test developer. There is a fee, it has been going up. Talk about fees later. The investigational use requirements are those related to the IDE exempt rule. So the FDA expects any study to go through an IRB. The IRB can say this might present a significant risk and we can't determine it. Then you can go to the FDA and ask the FDA, is this a significant risk study? If they say yes, then you're required to file an IDE. Now, the FDA has really driven down the timelines for IDE review. At my office, we did most of those reviews, single cycle review, and within 30 days. And we tracked that very closely, like we did every other metric. So at the end of year three, there will be an additional quality system potential requirements. And probably the most complex thing about this FHIR rule is figuring out, you know, what quality system requirements a lab might have. And whereas there were, I thought, two clear levels of quality system for labs in the proposed, I think there is at least three different levels. Very light, I call light, and full. Most labs are going to be able to get in with very light and light, depending on their circumstances. And some labs, like those that are New York State approved, may only need to follow records and not design controls and not purchasing controls. So it could be a really quite light touch if you're New York State approved. At the end of 3.5 years, anybody who comes in with a Class 3 device needs to have their Class 3 device test completely submitted by the end of 3.5 years. As long as it's complete and submitted by the end of that period, the FDA will allow you to stay on the market while they review. Very similar to what the FDA did following the February 29th, 2020 guidance for COVID EUAs from lab-developed tests. At 4 years, the moderate and low complex, there's some enforcement discretion, you know, for forensics, HLA, public health surveillance, and pre-1976 manual. And then they're not excluding EUAs, direct-to-consumer, and donor screening. Some preliminary thoughts. So it looks like nearly everyone got something. More on this later. Exclusions. The DOD and the Veterans Administration are not required to submit to the FDA. They're encouraged to use FDA-approved or cleared tests when they're used. Integrated health systems or labs within health systems don't have to submit to the FDA as long as they are part of that system and treating their own patients. Now, if there's an FDA-approved or cleared test, they should use that. Any test that's unmet, so there's not an FDA-cleared approved test, it gets a large pass. A test lots prior to the rule, there's a grandfather. New York State approved tests. New York State may be swamped for a very, very long time because that you know allows them not to have to submit to the FDA. And I would say that most large reference labs have most of their LETs already approved by New York State. The FDA will likely be very busy answering questions for a long time. The EUAs have changed slightly. There's a public health provision. There's two new draft guidances. Lawsuits. So I don't know. I was convinced there was going to be lawsuits, when the proposed rule came out. Now, I don't know if it's advisable to sue. The bar right now is so low with this final rule, lower than valid. I don't know why you'd want valid when you have this final rule, And I know we're almost time. So we can talk about legislation, and then I'll make the statement. It might be possible that no LDT test has to be submitted to the FDA under this proposed rule. I mean, how low is that bar? And then I think RUO kits developed for clinical labs, I think there's going to be a tightening of the screws by the FDA on oversight of RUO kits that are clearly designed for clinical lab use. And with that, thank you.
Thank you, Tim. Great, as expected. I'll have you stay up here and grab a seat, and maybe also invite Dr. Bien Wilner and Lila back up to the stage for our panel discussion.
This concludes the presentation. Please visit the Executive War College website for details on the 2025 event.